Empower Radio presents The Farkas Files, an exploration of energy, metaphysics, and the paranormal with David Franklin Farkas. The Farkas Files. The truth is in here, somewhere. Here's your host, David Franklin Farkas.
Good evening. Thanks for being with us. It's evening here. It could be who knows when, wherever you are. And that's part of the excitement of doing this kind of show. My guest tonight is Dawn Dancing Otter, and I'm really excited to talk to her. I've known her for quite a while online and know the work that she does, and it will be fascinating to hear more. But first, tonight's metaphysical musing, which is going to be a daddy moment. I got a text message this morning from my daughter, who is off at college. She's actually doing her first co-op job assignment this semester, so she doesn't have classes. She's actually working through the semester. And she sent me a picture of the letter that she got telling her she was on the dean's list. So obviously, I'm very excited that she's a good student and she got honored for that, and that she started my day by sending me this cool little message that included a letter and all of that. She's an amazing kid. We've had a great time. We've had a great time together. I was the stay-at-home parent, so we're a team here. You know, she's a teenager, so not quite like it was before, but we're pretty close. And one of the things that's been really fascinating to watch is how technology has affected parenting and communication. You know, it started when she was 10 years old or so with a cell phone, so I could give her a longer leash. She could go down to the center of town, and if I knew where she was and she responded to my calls, we were all good. She would go with a friend, and it was right in town, and she never had to cross a street that was really busy. It was a wonderful thing to be able to let her do all of that. And then, at some point, text messaging started. Obviously, it was there for a long time, but suddenly the kids got a hold of it, and it became the thing that they did to communicate. And the fascinating thing was, if I called her on the cell phone, she was going to get annoyed. I was interrupting her. She was doing whatever she was doing, talking to her friends, and, oh, my God, my dad's calling me. But if I sent her a text message, she was doing text messages all the time with, you know, several friends and checking in with people. And if I sent her a text message, it was no big deal. And she would just respond to it, and we could have whatever communication we needed to have. And it wasn't that big emotional interruption of dad calling. What's he calling for now? And that, in many ways, has gotten even better and continued, especially now that you can send each other pictures by text in addition to the other ways that we can send pictures. And it's really interesting, for all the negative things about text messaging and people having their heads down and not paying attention to what's going on around them. And that's one of my pet peeves, is both people walking around texting, but people walking around with headphones on. I lived in, I lived in Brooklyn in the city of New York when I was a kid. And I went to school by subway through high school and then college. I was on the subway a lot. And it was before cell phones, and it was before text messaging. And it was a time, you know, crime and the dangers of big cities in general, but New York in particular, have really been diminished over the last few decades. But when I was there, that was not the case. So it was a dangerous place, and you needed to pay attention. I don't understand people who wear headphones walking around in public. It makes me I, you know, set myself up for all kinds of wisecracks if I say it makes me crazy, but I can't understand people wanting to make themselves less aware of their environment and more susceptible to a predator of any kind. You know, muggers look for good marks, and a good mark is someone who either looks scared or isn't paying attention or both. They never came after me. Because I would smile at everybody on the street and say, hi, how are you today? And look them in the eye. And I was like, oh, he's not a mark. And they would look away from me, not the other way around. So people that are walking around with headphones on have eliminated one sense that allows them to have an early warning system. And if you're also looking at your cell phone, you've now eliminated sight as well. So as somebody who, you know, what was a kid in a dangerous place, but also who has done ambulance and rescue and worked with the police department, so looking at cell phones while you're walking and listening to headphones just doesn't compute for me. I watch people do it and I go, oh, don't do that. You don't understand. Someday this is going to come back and bite you. But getting back to my kid and the text messages, and this morning, so she sent me this thing and I sent her, you know, a message back that was hooping and hollering and being silly. And she sent something back that was basically, thank you. And then I cracked a joke and she cracked a joke and it went back and forth for, I don't know, half a dozen messages. And that was the beginning of my day. It was absolutely wonderful. It took all of 4 minutes. So for all the bad things that people say about text messaging and all the craziness that can go on between parents and their teenage college kids, there's some really cool stuff that goes on, and text messaging can be part of that, and it certainly is with my kid. And I am very, very grateful for all of it. It was a really cool way to start my day. And that's today's metaphysical musing, a daddy moment from my life. So my guest tonight is Dawn Dancing Otter. And Dawn, I don't even know if you have another name. I've only known you as Dawn Dancing Otter.
That's in fact my legal name now. I think
cool.
In 2006. Yeah. So that's the name that's on my passport and everything. But yes, I've been known by other names.
But it shows in many ways how much you have integrated in the, you know, quotation marks, real world, the shamanic work and identity that you have. And you do an amazing array of work, which we'll talk about in a minute. But what I always say, and just so people will have an idea, the tip off is your slight accent. You're located in British Columbia, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, which is.
Do I have an accent? That's so interesting.
You sound a little Canadian, eh?
Oh, isn't that funny? Yes. You know, it's up here we don't notice, right?
So. Right. Of course. Of course. Most Canadian accents are fairly subtle and relatively indistinguishable from Minnesota.
Yeah, true that.
So what I always ask my guests is for the story of your walkabout, how did you wind up doing this amazing stuff that you're doing? And so please share with us, how'd you get here?
Well, it's really interesting because coming into doing the work that I do now really does very much feel like I came home. When I was little, I have memories of being, you know, 2 and 3 years old, but I used to have very intricate conversations with beings that weren't in the physical, and that I would consider them to be really spirit guides. You know, as a child, I had such a strong connection with those beings, largely, I think, because I was an introvert. And it's interesting because I'm still an introvert, but you wouldn't sort of remark that is a big part of my life because I spend so much time with people. I'm quite introverted. As a child, I was painfully shy, and I loved my family, but I had a really difficult time with anyone that I didn't know. Mm-hmm. And I was very insecure as a child. I felt that the world was a beautiful, God-filled place. And I also felt that there was a weight of kind of misery and cruelty going on. And it was difficult for me to reconcile that as a child. So I spent more and more time talking to spirits when I was younger. And it was really great because they helped to cultivate a sense of peace and purpose even as a child. Though a child that speaks to beings that aren't visible to everyone is often ridiculed and thought of as weird and ostracized by other kids and that right. kind of stuff. And that was certainly my experience. I didn't have very many friends when I was growing up, and that wasn't for lack of desire or trying. It just sort of happened that way. When I got a bit older, I began to study dance when I was a really little kid. And when I got a bit older, I began to get really serious about it. And that was a major part of my growing up, was spent studying dance and becoming ready to be professional on that level. And that was my expectation, that I would become a professional dancer. For me, that time was a time of darkness because I kind of shut down a major part of my receptivity to inspiration. And I went into a fairly self-destructive pattern because I felt very insecure about my form, my physicality. Me not being sort of as small as a lot of the ballerinas that I could see in the world, I felt always this impending sense that I needed to alter or change my body. And that part of me continued for quite a while. I was then, kind of interestingly enough, found myself by chance in a voodoo ceremony brought by my friend. And it's actually voodoo is the name of it, but voodoo is sort of the common term that people think of. And I'd been brought there by a friend, and it was a very kind of unexpected experience. And I gather that it was not something that commonly happened, that people were brought to this ceremony. And I felt completely right at home during that time. I was, 19? I was completely at home, and I felt really loved and nurtured in the circle. And I felt like the medicine was really beautiful. And in a sense, that really brought back that beautiful connection to the spiritual beings that were holding me and keeping me safe when I was young. And I felt this resurgence of purpose. It didn't change the whole world for me in that moment, but it certainly began to enlighten me. And after that time, I got really interested in South American dance, Afro-Cuban dance, West African dance. So I began to really change my focus in how I was experiencing dance. I changed into a major of contemporary dance instead of ballet. And so my whole being began to shift towards this whole idea of coming into the earth. And what contemporary dance does is it really moves us into an earthier experience of movement. We do a lot of falling into the earth, a lot of being caught by the earth, a lot of deep reverence and bending into the earth. A lot of our movements really require us to know the earth well, and that part of me began to awaken again. And West African dance again took me deeper into more ecstatic states. Actually, when I was in movement, I then began to study Ashtanga yoga, and that was something that came into my life and was a strong and very, very present aspect of my daily life for a long time. I studied in India four times in order to really solidify that teaching within me, I went to the Ashtanga Research Institute in Mysore to complete a program that, or to complete my education with the style to the sufficient to the point where I felt like I could be here and practice it and feel like I was still moving forward. And that again reawakened a lot of ecstatic state within me because we were sweating hard. We were moving into deep space in terms of the positions of our body. We were releasing a lot of energy. We were going into deep states of meditation. So for me, this was a huge foundation point for me. All of that work was a foundation. What happened after that was really interesting because I've suffered from eating disorders all of my life. Up until I was about 35, I've had some presence of eating disorder in my life. And at that point in time, so I just finished my massage therapy degree, and I just gotten married and had a baby and all that. I started to get really sick. And getting really sick was something that that I didn't make room for in my life. You know, I didn't feel like I had time to be sick or really that I could, that would ever happen to me, that realization would ever happen to me, never occurred to me that that was possible. And even still, while I was feeling sick, I was still working, I was still massaging, I was still teaching yoga, I was still doing all kinds of work that was really, really physical. And teaching dance still creating dance. And for me, that process, that exhausting process was me letting go of the last bits of my old life. And I got to a point in my sickness where, from a medical perspective, they were looking at leukemia because my blood was, you know, my blood testing was way off the charts in terms of my white blood cells, and my red blood cells were so low, and they were looking at mutations in my red blood cells. So, and because that's something that kind of cancer runs in my family, it was kind of a scary experience to be experiencing that. I went to see my naturopath, and my naturopath was like such an amazing angel. She still is a very much a big part of my life. Monica Herwig from Canmore, Alberta. She recommended that I go and see Manfred. And Manfred was her friend and teacher and shaman. And he he just passed away January 1st, but he lived in Cochrane, Alberta. And I went to see him, and they're sitting on a buffalo skin. I was so in love and enamored with the whole experience. Actually, you know, he played his drum for me, but there sitting on the buffalo skin after the journey, he looked at me in the eyes and he said, you know, Dawn, your power animal is the otter. And I started to laugh because that just seemed absurd to me at the time. It just seemed absurd. I said, no, that's crazy. Like I started to even feel almost a little angry. And he said, why do you think that's crazy? And I said, I know I'm a horse. I know I am. And he said, well, what do horses mean to you? And I said, well, horses are strong and capable and they're free. You know, they're so physical, they're so beautiful. Like that's what they are, you know? And he said, and horses can carry a lot on their backs, can't they? And I said, yes. And he said, well, here's the thing. That's why you're sick. Because you don't know who you are, and you don't know why you're here, and you don't know what you're good for.
Wow.
And it hit me like it was hitting me right between the eyeballs, you know? And after that medicine, I started to get well again. It was about a year after that medicine where I was, you know, really recovered from a medical perspective. But I was also left with a feeling of being on fire for something. You know, I was finally on fire for something that seemed to mean the world to me, you know. And Manfred became my teacher. And Manfred, as I said, he just died January 1st was an amazing teacher for me because he was a Buffalo man. He had beautiful boundaries in a sense that safety was important. And I didn't know that in my life. I had no concept of that, you know, that safety might need to be important. And he held me in so much safety during those teachings. And I've studied with several other teachers in my life since then that have been major forces coming along the path. As I've moved along the path, what I've discovered is that it was really something that was forged for me, that I couldn't have known that this was what I was supposed to be doing. I would have, if you'd told me that 20 years ago, I would have said you were crazy, you know?
I know exactly what you mean.
I would have had no preconception about what this would be. I had no part of that in my life, you know, in a big sort of out front and obvious way. And when I really examine it, David, I've had people calling me shaman since I was a kid, you know, right out to my face, but it didn't seem like an important thing, you know, until much later. And now I've come into this place where I walk the path and I realize the service of it is the responsibility is massive. As I walk this path, it's not a burden. It's a responsibility. It's an active responsibility, which means that on a daily basis, I do my own spiritual work. I clear my own space so that I'm not walking into a space with someone asking them to bear the load of my responsibility. Mm-hmm. So I guess one would call that the hollow bone. It's been called that. I really feel that's what a hollow bone is someone who takes the responsibility of doing their own spiritual work so that when they walk into a space, they can allow for whatever is needed to move even through them without being attached. And so for me, that's the path I walk now. And it means the world to me. And it also has lightened my baggage because I don't feel any level of stress about that. You know, it feels so powerful and awesome, but it's also a relief.
Right.
It's a relief to know that this practice lives through me. It's a relief to know that it's here, that I'm filled with its purpose. And so that's my spiral walk through this journey. And I'm still, you know, as much as Spirit is asking me to be here and doing this work, I'm here and doing this work. And the moment that Spirit says to me, that's enough, you're done, that'll be enough and I'll be done. But for the moment, I'm here, I'm doing this work, and it's been a creative and a huge light in my life. It's been such an inspiration for me to be walking this path.
And I know you're doing wonderful things. This is a perfect place for us to get ready for the break. So I want to hear more about what you're doing, because you're doing some amazing things and you have schools and all kinds of stuff. Let's tell people where they can get in touch with you. What's your web address?
So it's www.dancingotter.ca.
And for those that are not familiar with the .ca extension, that's Canada.
That's Canada.
Rather than .com. And you're also on Facebook?
I am. And I'm not even sorry to say that anymore. I used to be sheepish about it. And I'm actually kind of proud of it. But yes, we're on Facebook. I have a profile, but I also have a community page that is the largest shamanic community on Facebook. And it's called the Shamanic Community. And it's an open
group.
And
we have some interesting conversations happening there.
Yes, we do. Right now, as it happens.
Indeed. So we're going to be going to the break, and we will be back shortly, unless, of course, we get taller. With my guest, Dawn Dancing Otter, here on Empower Radio on the Farkas Files. Truth is in here somewhere. Don't go nowhere. We'll be right back.
come to the forest, it's a place not so far away. A place where you don't have to mow the lawn or babysit.
I saw lizards and squirrels and bugs.
Ladybugs, caterpillars. It's really cool, actually.
A place where you don't have to make time for free time.
Lots and lots of kinds of species here.
Out here, you may even meet the mysterious creature known as the other you. The enchanted you.
It's magic what flowers do.
The adventurous you.
My favorite tree, yes, is that one.
The free-to-be-me you. Ask your parents to take you to this not-so-far-away place. Come to the forest, where the other you lives. But first, stop by discovertheforest.org, a public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Do you get tired of styling your hair every day? And do you want a good hairstyle every day? Hi, I'm Sarah Schuster. I went on a website called inventnow.org, and after that, I decided to invent something too. Something called the Insta-Do. Just imagine, you just put it over your head like a helmet does, and you pick your hairstyle with the buttons on the side. Then you can have instant hairstyle in seconds. People like it. People like Jeff Bart.
I like it.
And people like Kenneth.
It's this helmet thing, and it fits over your head, and it's
great. Thank you, Kenneth. You should go to inventnow.org, and it could help you come up with your own invention. After all, look at me on the radio now.
Anything's possible. Keep thinking. Get started on your own inventions, or just play some games at inventnow.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the National Inventors Hall of Fame Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Hey, Larry, mind if I sit down?
Nope.
This coffee tastes like coffee. So what's going on?
Not much.
What's new?
Not much.
Okay, but can you please put the newspaper down while you say not much?
What newspaper?
This newspaper. Oh, dude! What happened to your face? I see one, two,
ow,
three, four, five, six,
ow,
seven. Dude, what is
ow
this? 11 pieces of toilet paper stuck to your face?
I'm shaving in the dark to save energy. I'm helping the environment.
That's a dangerous way to help the environment.
Well, sometimes you have to sacrifice yourself for the greater good.
Dude, there's an easier and safer way to help the environment without sacrificing yourself. Go green, go public. Take public transportation. It's good for the environment and you won't have to live behind a newspaper.
Wow.
But for now, put the newspaper back up.
A message from the public transportation systems across the country. To learn more, visit publictransportation.org.
Now, back to the Farkas Files with David Franklin Farkas on Empower Radio.
And we're back with Dawn Dancing Otter from British Columbia, who is doing some amazing shamanic work. And please tell us about all the different things you're doing and the programs you've started.
I'd be happy to. So, interestingly enough, as I started my practice doing shamanic counseling with people here, and I really did start actually in Canmore, Alberta, where I was living at the time, what started to happen was people were asking me to teach, and that seemed completely off the charts, unusual for anyone to ask me to do that, because I didn't feel like I was, you know, experienced enough or enlightened enough or like smart enough to teach this kind of work to anybody. And I realized in those moments, you know, that I said, I don't know enough to teach. And my own teacher said to me, you know, I know very little. I know enough to know that I know very little. And it's not about, what you know, it's about living your destiny. It's about being on your path. And so I, at some point, stopped saying no to people when they were asking me to teach. And I began to teach a workshop series out here in BC when I began to foster a community out here in the Okanagan. And I live in Penticton, BC, so I started to do some workshops out here. And those were immediately very, very full experiences. People were coming for the learning. They seemed really hungry for it. Three or four years later, it was sort of the very early part of my teaching experience, I was contacted from a man in Croatia who asked me if I would come out and teach in Zagreb, and which [S2]
Wow. [S1]
Seemed completely ridiculous to me. I was like, why do you want me to come and teach you? I mean, gosh, like, that's a really old and traditional type of culture you're in. I'm sure you have medicine people, but he really wanted me to come out and teach. And so I agreed to go. And I taught my first workshop in Zagreb. And some of the students from that workshop were beginning to share information with other people. And one of the people that picked up on some of that information that I had left behind was my current sort of major apprentice and host in Bosnia, Chef Kobayek. And he hosts me every year now, and we're building a school in the Balkans that has a regular attendance of students. And I now have, it's really sort of 8 apprentices that are working towards becoming teachers and working towards becoming more knowledgeable, so that, that we can actually begin to share more of the information in their own language, as opposed to me going there and being translated, right. Which is awesome, but it's also, it's really not the same thing as feeling that information within the language. And so what I'm really trying to nurture is for them to find the roots of the practice within their own country, within their own heritage. And that's something that actually has to be dug around deeply into the muck, because a lot has happened in that part of the world, and they're not as close to their shamanic traditions as they used to be. That's a work in progress. We're doing a lot of work around land healing in that area, specifically around areas that have experienced a lot of bloodshed. That's been incredibly healing for not only myself, but the people that come to those ceremonies. And every year I do a water ceremony at the Danube there. I also do retreats here in Canada. I've done a few in the States, not so many, mostly in Western, in the Western US. So Portland, Seattle, I did 2 workshops a while back in California. And then, I go as frequently as I can to Peru, to the Amazon. And, we're going again in October of this year for 2 weeks. So yeah, it's exciting to be able to.
As the saying goes,
incredible world.
But other than that, what are you doing?
Wow. Well, you know, surprisingly, it doesn't feel like my life is that exciting to me. You know, it is very exciting, but it doesn't feel like it's moving and shaking. It feels very peaceful. I suppose on a moving and shaking kind of place, the shamanic community on Facebook, that experience of moderating and being the founder of that group has been really enlightening, but it's also incredibly, it's a lot of work.
And, no doubt.
Always keeps me on my toes. And I appreciate some, it's an evolving practice. This practice is so old. And as one of our admins, Randy Jones, would say, it's revolving. It's also evolving, this process of being with the shamanic, in the shamanic frame of being, in the shamanic worldview, is evolving and revolving. And I love that we get to see that on a daily basis in the group.
Yeah, that's an amazing group. I've been both enjoying it and challenged by it. a wide, wide range of people. I want to get back a minute to your land healing work, because that's a lot of what I do.
And, great.
You know, and I'm doing it differently because I'm a sole practitioner doing it remotely. Mm-hmm. So I would love to hear what you're doing, especially in places like that where there's been so much pain and so much violence.
Well, I come from the point of view of using every experience rather than just mourning for the things that you can't change. Mm-hmm. To actually taking ownership of the things that happened in order to allow for them to make peace and to reconcile each of us as a person in that space. So when we do these ceremonies, it's not about trying to remove the damage that's been done. It's actually trying to contextualize it, trying to own it in a responsibility place, to be walking this earth as a responsible human being on this land, knowing what's happened on the land, knowing it, that you're ancestrally connected, and because none of us are separate, we're all connected to what has happened on that land. So when we stand on the actual fully potentialized charge of that land, because when you're standing on a piece of earth that has that holds the charge, you're that much closer to it. So the influence on your own being is stronger. You know, it's a stronger potency. So the ability to make changes within ourselves using that mirror of that land, so that we can become, we can become it. You know, we can forgive ourselves. We can forgive what's happened before and make peace with what has happened before. And that has an amazing ripple effect in the world. It's not just what happens within the group, but what happens to each person that touches every person who's been to the ceremony, and what happens to the people that come through that part of the land that has been reclaimed and cleansed. And that cleansing effect of not washing away what's happened, but to simply own it, to simply say, yes, you know, I'm prepared to receive the wisdom that comes from this lesson learned, because that's really, I think, all we can do as human beings. We can't erase what happened. And certainly a lot has happened over there. I've heard, heartbreaking testimony from people. So if you want to talk about things that challenge a person's heart, I am a very, very, I just love people so much. And when I hear people tell their stories, it just really moves me to my core, you know. And I've heard so many stories, so many heartfelt stories, not just tragic ones, but ones of, you know, people reaching out and helping each other. And people, one of my favorite stories is when my apprentice Shevko talks about how people in Sarajevo had no food during the war. So they were planting gardens and they were sharing food with each other. They were planting gardens in the public parks so that they could share food with each other, and that they looked after each other during that time. And that, to me, you know, we can talk about the tragedy and focus on that, but we can also see the wellspring of beauty and humanity in peace with and in harmony with the earth, actually, coming together. And to me, I think that's something I wish everybody could go there. I wish everybody could go there, because it would contextualize a lot of our fears and judgments about places that go through war, you know, and because it was so recent, it, you know, really Kosovo was 99.
Right.
So it was so recent that that area was ignited, you know. So, I wish everyone could go there and feel that. It changed me. To be there.
Yeah, the stories that tend to be told are the horror stories of war, because that's what news is.
You know, yes.
The saying in the news industry is, if it bleeds, it leads, which has been around for a very, very long time. You know, people get sucked in by the stories of the pain. But there's always a parallel set of stories of how people took care of each other, and, you know, what was done for the most vulnerable people and all of that. So it's wonderful that you can work with that and also bring those stories back. It's 'cause we don't hear them.
Well, I mean, I certainly didn't. I was very unaware of what happened over there until I went there. And what I found was really interesting is that depending on who you were talking to, there were many different perspectives as to what was going on and why it was going on.
Right.
So I don't know that everyone, even on the inside, knew what was going on during that time or what the war was about, you know. And certainly people have their perspectives of it being about religion or about politics or about land or about money even, you know. But I think if you were to focus on only one of those things, you would have a very small fragment of the story.
Right.
And you stand on that land and realize that there's been upheaval for 500 years at least. You know,
right.
This is why we have to go back into these spaces and make peace, because, you know, this is what human beings do in the interaction on the earth, and the earth claims that energy. It claims it, it holds it, and we have to reclaim it because it belongs to us. You know, we put it there. So
yeah, that anchoring of the energy in a particular place is very, very common. So, you know, if there were a battle or a disagreement or whatever level of that kind of violent interaction that happens, and you then 300 or 1,000 years later build a house on that spot, the people that will be attracted to it, well, first of all, the building of the house and the financing and all the rest of it will have some version of whatever the original struggle was.
Mm-hmm.
And then the people who move into it will resonate with whatever the land is carrying. So I've talked to landlords and said, you know, do you notice that no matter how many times there's a turnover of the families in certain apartments, that they're always basically the same, that the drug addicts are in one apartment and the violent people are in another apartment, and, you know, the kinds of things that are going on in the apartments wind up being the same? And he said, yeah, I never understood that. And so, yeah, it started that way, and people wind up in that place because of the resonance, and then they bring their own version of it there and increase the energy of it.
Right.
Until someone comes along and breaks that chain, does the healing work that's necessary to release that.
Yeah, exactly. And thankfully, David, you know, more people are seeing the need for that and understanding the call to do just that.
Right.
And I feel that it was very much a part of who we were as shamanic societies growing through the ages. We used to do that. That's what all of our ceremonies were about, were a relationship, not just between ourselves, but with the land. And, you know, we used to do that.
Yeah, it's been lost. I've watched here, there'll be public buildings with horrible histories. So we had psychiatric hospitals and hospitals where the developmentally disabled would live out their lives, with thousands of people buried in unmarked graves. You know, it was going on for hundreds of years. And then the programs get shut down and they have all these buildings and they don't know what to do with it. And either they try to repurpose the buildings and make them into apartments or make them into, you know, an industrial space or whatever they do, or they knock everything down thinking that that'll take it away. And the ones that I've watched here, they wind up selling off the property around the fringe of the institution where the energy is not as intense, and they can get those sold off and they can't do anything on the original property. Or they do things on the property and the businesses fail. And it's because they haven't done that work of clearing both the energy of the struggle and the horrors that happened there, but also releasing the souls that were still attached to that land, that lived and died and struggle on that land. And that's important work. And in some parts of the world, at least they have some vague sense of what I'm talking about and you're talking about. And they don't know who could do it or how to do it, but they know something's wrong. But here in the States, pretty much it's just business and people don't think of it. Other than they walk on the land and get shivers and wonder why.
Yeah, isn't that the thing? You know, we all have a capacity to be sensory within that experience, and to, if we choose to actually pay attention, and we start to learn that, you know, that sensory experience is not to make us afraid, but to actually invite us to do something about it. You know?
Right. Well, the fear is that people first don't know what it is, and secondly, don't think it can be fixed. don't think that there is something they can do.
But thankfully, you know, one person may know another person may know another person that knows you, for example, and taps you on the shoulder and makes you aware of it. You know, it's wonderful that we're beginning to see that kind of network happen through this work of earth medicine. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's also happening through communities online, which is one of the reasons that what you're doing and other people are doing, bringing people together to have those conversations, is so important. It's not because it creates part of that network.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. I feel very blessed about that. The fact that we have that potency going on in the shamanic community group, that we have the ability to connect and share information. Yes, some people find that very frustrating experience because they're not interested in everything that gets posted, and there's always a lot. But they don't like a personality of a person who posts or what have you. But I love that we sort of delight in the tolerance of each other from time to time, and we actually then get to share some real information. Yeah.
And it's such a wide range of experience and traditions that, you know, people get hung up on things being different from what they are familiar with, or, you know, what my teacher said and what your teacher said, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are always fun conversations. But, you know, I suppose that you can't know something until you know it. And a lot of times that's the beauty of the process of opening up discussions, is that you unearth the ignorance. Like I certainly don't know everything. I'm not even close. I know like a little pinprick of information in a universe, but at the same time that I'm curious more than I am willing to be right. I'm willing to be curious, and for me that means that I always have the potential to learn something. And so I encourage people just to be curious. They can sure want to be right, and that's great, because I mean everybody's like that from time to time. I want to be right sometimes too, but you know at the same time it's like, can we just be curious a little bit? And curiosity I feel is at the heart of shamanism, actually. You know, that
well, it's interesting.
Curiosity,
at least in theory, is at the core of science.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
Right. And I find scientific skeptics who look at this stuff and just won't even accept it as possible, to which my reply is, what do you do with the results? You know, everything in science starts with anecdotal evidence. There's consistent results here. You can choose to push it aside and not look at it, or you can choose to be curious and figure out why you can't measure it yet. And I'm sure at some point they will figure out what needs to be done to take the measurements, and then everyone will go, oh, we always knew that.
Yeah, they'll get I imagine it'll look like that, some of those meters on Ghostbusters, you know, like they were measuring whatever that was, ectoplasmic stuff with those. Yeah, I imagine like at some point someone's going to invent that, and then we'll have some sort of evidence-based work through shamanism, that something measurable, some kind of computer program that it measures things.
There is some work. Well, there's work being done in Russia and China, because those places and traditions have not blocked it out of their consciousness. But in the United States, there are a handful of scientists doing hard science about it, including Dean Radin at the Institute of Noetic Sciences. They get consistent results.
Isn't that just amazing? What a blessing to us, hey, that the Institute of Noetic Studies, that is something else. And I feel very strongly that we need to work in the process of curiosity and making connections, because to me, science, shamanism, those are same, just like my beautiful Kundalini yoga teacher, Satkar, would say, same. You know, this is same.
Well, you know, my sort of joke is, the only difference between shamanism and science is that we acknowledge that we are not only the observer, we are what is being observed, we are the experiment, and we are also the apparatus.
Mm, yes, right, exactly.
And so is everybody else, but they're saying they can separate it out. And I was like, no, everything's connected. You can't separate it out. You're affecting the experiment, whether you're trying to isolate it or not.
Isn't it fascinating? And that's the one thing that is so beautiful, because I don't pretend. I mean, I love science. Don't get me wrong. Love it. Like, I love it.
Mm-hmm.
I love, for example, anatomy and physiology. I love it. That stuff I can get. It's so juicy and I can get right into it and just, you know, the function of a cell or the function of the of the endocrine system or, you know, those things just excite me. I love science. However, I don't pretend as a shamanic person to try and you know, make a connection that doesn't feel like it fits. I just know that it does, right? Like I never try and convince people of something that their mind is trying to block for good reason. I simply feel it's important to just continue to do the walk and see that the work continues to blossom, and then the results actually then create an atmosphere of curiosity, because the person can then go, why did that happen?
Right.
And we can say, well, this is what we did, you know? And just, you know, as shamanic people, to stop asking permission to be valid. This was science. This was medicine. You know, this is what we had. Nothing that we have now as a science or as a medicine or as a philosophy or as a religion would exist without the first connection of shamanism.
Right. And shamanism goes back in every culture on the planet for thousands of years. Thousands.
My first teacher, Manfred, he would say that shamanism is the roots and everything else in that list is a branch. And none of the branches are in conflict with the roots. You know, none of those branches are in conflict with the roots.
Right. So they just think so.
They can't see the roots, so they don't realize they're there, you know?
Right.
But that interconnection, if we understand that shamanism, you know, we grow it from our hearts, from our open-hearted willingness to be curious and to not stick to just what we know and the patterns that we've made in the past, that actually we're walking here in the process of breaking up those patterns so that we can be free to make choices.
And that's the perfect statement for us to wind down on, because as usual with fantastic people like you, we're running out of time. We could keep going for another hour at least.
I know. I can't even believe that was an hour. That's crazy.
So give people your web address again.
It's dancingotter.ca.
.ca. And of course on Facebook, it's Dawn Dancing Otter.
Yeah, Dawn Dancing Otter, three words. And the shamanic community is the group that I founded.
Fantastic. Dawn, thanks so much for being on the show. This has been
such a pleasure,
great
David.
Fun.
Thank you
great,
so much.
Great fun. And stay on the line. We'll chat a little bit after we go off the air.
Okay, sounds good.
And if by any chance you've gotten curious about who this guy David is and what strange stuff he does, you can go to househealing.com. And cleverly hiding in plain view like everything else in the world. On the contact tab is every way you can possibly get in touch with me, including a scheduling link. I do a free 20-minute assessment of whatever's going on with a person, place, situation, and we can see how my work might be helpful to you. So please take advantage of that. If you want more about the show, you can go to, cleverly enough, thefarkasfiles.com, and the entire archive of however many years it's been that we've been doing this, I'm not even sure anymore, but hundreds and hundreds of interviews with amazing people are there. You can also find us on iTunes Podcasts, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and who knows where else. Just search for Empower Radio or The Farkas Files. So, thank you so much for being with us. This is David Franklin Farkas for the Farkas Files. The truth is in here somewhere on Empower Radio. Have a fantastic week.